There are times in our lives when we're open to new friendships, moving to a new town, starting a new job, and of course, the friendships forged in childhood. But what about later, when you least expect it? Gail Caldwell, a Texan transplant feeling very at home in Boston, Massachusetts, was happily living her life, writing book reviews for the Boston Globe, training a new dog. She was in her early 40s then and not looking for friendships, thank you very much. And then she met Caroline Knapp, also a writer in Boston. And once Gail Caldwell let Caroline Knapp into her life, their lives became thoroughly intertwined. And then Caroline died. Gail Caldwell has written a memoir of their friendship, Let's Take the Long Way Home. And she joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the show, Gail Caldwell.
Thank you, Jackie. It's nice to be here.
This is such a lovely, lovely story, I have to tell you.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Would you please begin it for us right at the beginning?
Sure. It's an old, old story. I had a friend and we shared everything. And then she died, and so we shared that, too. The year after she was gone, when I thought I had passed through the madness of early grief, I was on the path at the Cambridge Reservoir where Caroline and I had walked the dogs for years. It was a winter afternoon, and the place was empty. There was a bend in the road with no one ahead of or behind me, and I felt a desolation so great that for a moment my knees wouldn't work. "What am I supposed to do here?" I asked her aloud, by now accustomed to conversations with a dead best friend. "Am I just supposed to keep going?" My life had made so much sense alongside hers. For years, we had played the easy, daily game of catch that intimate connection implies. One ball, two gloves, equal joy in the throw and the return. Now I was in the field without her, one glove, no game. Grief is what tells you who you are, alone.
How long after your friend died did you write that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I wrote the first sentence probably 4 years or 3 years after she died, but it was all I could write of this book. I left it on a legal pad and went on to other things. It was all I could write for at least a year. And then when I began the book, I was able to write the rest of it.
And she passed away in 2002, so it has been a while. When the two of you met, neither of you was looking for a friend. She had just broken up with someone. You had been through a lot of hurdles yourself. You're both very self-sufficient women.
And we both had new puppies, which was essential to the connection.
I've never had a new puppy, so you must draw me completely into this world.
Well, imagine being two moms in the park for which the dialogue is fascinating only to them, whether they're talking about, you know, insomnia or diaper changes. I mean, we had these two bundles of energy and had met and been reintroduced through a mutual dog trainer and friend of ours. And someone had said to us, you know, you and Caroline remind me of each other. You should really get together, which was an odd comment because, in fact, I think we looked nothing alike, but there was something oddly and spookily familiar about the two of us. Once we had taken the first walk, which probably lasted 5 hours, we both were sort of done. It was like, okay, we know what we have here.
This is such a rich friendship, Gail Caldwell. I mean, she teaches you to row a scull. You teach her to swim. You are both writers. You share that, but that you speak to each other at the end of the writing day or sometimes during it. You have this passionate love of canines. But part of what you also shared is that both of you were recovering alcoholics.
Caroline had just published her memoir, Drinking a Love Story, when I met her.
To great acclaim, we might add. That was a
very
popular book.
And so she was reeling from the public status that she had achieved very quickly. One of the things that always made me laugh in retrospect was that we had met years earlier, and when I think I'd been sober probably 5 years. And I asked her later, after we were friends, what she had thought about me the night we met. Because I remembered her hands. She had beautiful hands.
And this is at a literary gathering.
Yes, it was at a very bookish party that we were both enduring, as it turned out. And somebody had said, oh, you know, it introduced us, and we were very polite and then kind of moved away. And I asked her what she thought of me, and she said, I remember thinking that here was a woman who could probably drink and get away with it.
Mm.
And, of course, I was holding club soda, so she had no idea. But it was, in fact, one of the wellsprings of connection between us, and though we didn't know it when we first became friends.
I didn't let you finish your comment about her hands.
She had these, you know, it was funny because she was the strongest, physically strongest. I mean, she could pick me up. She could pick up Morelli.
Her boyfriend.
And she weighed about 108 pounds. And she was, I used to call her Brutita for Little Brute. But she had these hands that were always French manicured and elegant. And I think of it as a wonderful anomaly to the brute within.
A good part of this book takes place after this diagnosis, and I have to say there's such, by then, such clarity, such force, and such agonizing beauty. Could I get you, please, to read a bit? Let's go to page 158.
Memento mori, reminders of the dead. I think we must long for these signatures of history, the baseballs and ornaments and playing cards left on people's graves, because they take up the space left by the departed. The physical void after she was gone seemed alarmingly like a thing of physics, as if daylight had shifted or a house on the street had disappeared. Yesterday I found a note I had written to myself in the piles of outlines and narrative maps that are a writer's building blocks. "Let her die," I had written at the top of a legal pad, a shorthand reminder to get to that part of the story. Then I saw it the next day and half gasped. For a moment, it was as though someone else had given me the instruction. Let her die. A three-word definition of the arc of grief, if ever I heard one, and it takes a long time.
You've turned to a lot of friends and acquaintances who gave you important words to carry you through your grief. I particularly loved a scene where you and a very famous writer friend of yours, you are a longtime book critic, are reading poetry together over the phone. Mm-hmm. She's in Minnesota. You're mm-hmm. in Cambridge. When people turn to you now that you have come through this very great grief, what do you tell them about the experience and the journey?
The thing that I suppose I've learned, and this is one of the most humbling lessons of all about losing someone as essential as Caroline was to me, is that often there are no words that you can say. I was talking to a recent widow in my neighborhood whom I'm very fond of, and all of the well-intentioned sayings that we have, are you better? Are you, at least he's not suffering anymore? All the things that I think people often say, sometimes the best thing you can do is say nothing, and to be able to stand to be inside that grief with another person or respect it, because there are no shortcuts.
Gail Caldwell is the author of Let's Take the Long Way Home, and she joined us from WBUR in Boston. The book is her memoir of her friendship with the writer Caroline Knapp. Gail, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Long before there was Lisbeth Salander, the heroine of Stieg Larsson's phenomenally successful Millennium series, there was Martin Beck, another loner Swedish detective who investigated the bigger mysteries haunting the society of his time. Book critic Maureen Corrigan considers the utopian social fantasies offered up by both the Millennium series and its 1960s-era forerunner.
For the past few months, whenever I've found myself in a public space, in a Starbucks or doctor's waiting room, I always see somebody reading one of the novels in the Millennium series by Stieg Larsson. As a phenomenon, it's truly incredible. Millions upon millions of people in the U.S. alone, men and women, are captivated by a mystery series built around a main character who's an antisocial, bisexual, feminist, cyber genius avenger. Oh, and she's Swedish. Not since the arrival of IKEA on these shores has Sweden made such an inroad into the American home and imagination. As far as mystery fiction goes, though, Larson is the tippy top of a Nordic literary iceberg that's been moving inexorably into our waters over the past few decades. Before The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo landed in this country in 2008, Henning Mankell was the mystery writer that everybody was raving about. Mankell's fellow Swedes, Helene Tursten, who writes very good police procedurals, and Kirsten Ekman, whose novel Blackwater was a standout, also made their mark. So have Karen Fossum and Joe Nesbo from Norway, and the late crime master Jan Willem van der Vettering from Holland. If the years between the world wars were the golden age of British mystery, we've surely entered a new ice age. When I first read Stieg Larsson and heard his novels talked about as composing a multi-novel epic about contemporary Swedish society, a little chime went off in my head. I thought of an extraordinary pair of older Swedish mystery writers I haven't yet mentioned, Maj Sjöwall and Per Wallu. To anyone who loves crime fiction, Sjöwall and Wallu are immortals. Their Chief Inspector Martin Beck novels are still in print and still read, though their popularity has never approached anything like Larson's. Sjöwall and Wallu were married and together dreamt up the idea of writing 10 novels of 30 chapters each, composing an epic that spanned 10 years, from 1965 to 1975. Their aim, like Larson's, was to investigate society. In their own words, Sjöwall and Wallu said that they wanted to use detective fiction to wield a scalpel to lay open the soft belly of the morally debatable bourgeois welfare state, exposing the cancer that was eating away at Swedish society. At night, after they put their children to bed, Sjöwall and Wallu would sit down at a table together, facing each other. And from detailed outlines, they would simultaneously write alternate chapters of whatever Martin Beck novel they were then working on. To me, this sounds like a marital recipe for homicide, but it worked for Sjöwall and Wallu, and they wrote brilliant stories, among them The Fire Engine That Disappeared and The Laughing Policeman, about the growing violence in Swedish society and the upsurge in militant demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. To read the collective work of Sjöwall and Wallu and Larson is to have the dizzying illusion of reading one smart, entertaining, multi-volume work of social criticism focused on Sweden with pointed applications to America as well. But there's more. Great detective fiction doesn't only offer social criticism. It also contains utopian alternatives to a world gone wrong. For Sjöwall and Wallu, that utopian alternative, circa 1975, involved a recommitment to the ideals of social democracy. In the last scene of the last novel, The Terrorists, Martin Beck and one of his close colleagues are setting up a game of Scrabble. The colleague, who's quit the police in frustration, tells Beck that, "The trouble with you, Martin, is just that you've got the wrong job, at the wrong time, in the wrong part of the world, in the wrong system." Then he turns over his Scrabble square and says, "My turn to start? Then I say X. X. As in Marx." Compare that class-based solution to society's ills to the dream vision that Larson gives us. By the end of the Millennium series, a much more ragtag community of characters has come together, their very existence made possible by feminism and by the gay liberation movement. In uneasy alliance, they temporarily conquer the forces of cannibalistic capitalism, sexism, and international worker abuse. Such is the utopian dream that has infiltrated the psyches of the American reading public, blue-stater and red-stater. the astounding popularity of Larson's Millennium series is a testament to the undercover power of popular literature to transport us readers out of our hemmed-in worldviews.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University.
When essayist Ralph Eubanks feels the summer heat steaming from the pavement, he often thinks back to his Mississippi childhood, to one of his favorite refuges on a hot summer day, an air-conditioned bookmobile. A recent trip to Chicago conjured just such a memory when he happened upon a whole parade of bookmobiles.
There it was, an old Ford grille with big round headlights that was a dead ringer for the bookmobile that stopped at my house as a child. All of a sudden, I was transported into my boyhood self, waiting in the heat of my front porch for the Pine Forest Regional Library bookmobile to arrive at my house in rural Mississippi. Like the boy I once was, I shyly approached the door and asked if I could take a look inside. I stepped into a cool, air-conditioned bookmobile, and memories began to pour over me as I looked at the shelves and began to remember many of the books I borrowed. Across Five Aprils, Johnny Tremaine, My Side of the Mountain. One summer, I read every Agatha Christie mystery ever written. The summer I turned 11, William Faulkner's The Reavers came off the shelf of the bookmobile because I'd read it was being made into a movie and that the main character was my age. It was the first book I read by a Mississippi author, the first hint that someone from my part of the world could also become a writer. The bookmobile began stopping at my house in the summer of 1965, 1 year after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. As a boy, I took it for granted. A library on wheels was just part of the rural landscape. Isolated on a farm and oblivious to much of the turmoil of the civil rights movement, most Wednesdays I was finishing a book on the front steps when I heard the bookmobile's tires rush over the gravel in my driveway. The civil rights movement remained distant, even though I knew that because I was black, I could not go to our local public library. Even after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, Mississippi resisted enforcing it. But when my mother asked for the bookmobile to stop at our house in the summer of 1965, the librarian did not hesitate, even though schools were still segregated. By simply following the law rather than ignoring it, the bookmobile transformed me into a lifelong reader and, eventually, a writer. It was through reading that I became aware of the desire to tell my own stories. Reading also brought out my innate curiosity about human nature, which made me explore ideas beyond the page. So it is my identity as a reader that shaped the type of writer I am, and I owe that to an old Ford bookmobile, a summertime pleasure that changed the way I see the world. Rather than feeling alone and isolated in turmoil-ridden Mississippi in the late 1960s, a cool, air-conditioned library on wheels connected me to a world beyond the limits of where I grew up. In my life, that has made all the difference.
Ralph Eubanks is the author of Ever is a Long Time, A Journey into Mississippi's Dark Past. He's director of publishing at the Library of Congress.
Once again this summer, Morning Edition is exploring crime in the city. We're talking with crime novelists whose work illuminates the cities where the crime takes place, cities like London, Los Angeles, or Shanghai. Today we head for a very small city, the rugged and glamorous mountain resort town of Sun Valley, Idaho. Writer Ridley Pearson has written four thrillers starring the sheriff of Sun Valley, and his hero is based on the real sheriff. Linda Wertheimer met both the author and the lawman.
Ridley Pearson calls his fictional sheriff Walt Fleming, only a slight change from the real man's name, Walt Femling, They're friends. Pearson considers Femling his first editor. He runs ideas by him.
He's kind enough usually not to say, what a stupid idea, Ridley. But he, you know, just short of that. And then I go and do my work for a year, and Walt's the first guy to see the book.
The two Walts are not really alike, although they sort of look alike. In the second book, Killer View, Walt sees his reflection in the window of a pickup truck. Ridley Pearson writes, no one had ever called him handsome. The closest he'd gotten was good-looking, and that from a woman that no longer shared his bed. He blamed his sleepless nights on her. Sheriff Femling takes all that in stride. We went to the county jail to see him.
People come up to me and they say, hey, I just took a trip, I got books on tape, and I feel like I know you so much better now. And I want to tell them that, do you realize that's fiction? You know, it's not really who I am.
In Pearson's books, the criminals often show up at Sun Valley's most glamorous events. An assassin coming to a fundraiser for a woman who's a possible presidential candidate. Thieves crashing an auction of costly wines. These vicious visitors force the sheriff to ignore the locals and protect the VIPs. Sheriff Femling says that is not entirely fiction. There is real tension between working Idaho and the very rich who come and go.
You know, it's what you have to police. I mean, you can go from, you know, agricultural to, you know, the laborer to the King of Jordan I had last week. So now I'm doing a motorcade to move the King of Jordan and his family around last week, and I'm out on the desert for a lady who's run out of gas, you know, 2 hours away that needs help.
Besides the real sheriff, the real place plays a big role in Pearson's fiction. Starting with the Wood River Valley and the river itself, Hemingway fished there, and so do characters in Pearson's books. He took us to see it.
It's called the Big Wood River.
So we're standing by the Big Wood River. There's a wild rose bush right in front of me. It's very beautiful, and your job is to make it dangerous.
Yeah, my job is to bring out the danger. The danger's here. One of the things about a river is it looks tranquil. When this river is in its rage, which is late May, early June, it's an incredibly dangerous body of water. What's tranquil today is tomorrow's demon. And my job is really to find the demons.
The flooded river with trees floating in it is in the first scene of Pearson's new book. His sometime love interest, Fiona Kenshaw, is driving across a bridge. She sees a child's arm reaching out of a tree in the river.
I have actually been out inner tubing with friends and had a friend snagged and caught, and you get sucked under very fast, and you get held there and you drown. Because I'd had that experience, I thought I'd roll it into one of the books. So at the beginning of In Harm's Way, Fiona just happens to glance over a bridge. She sees a tree coming down, but it has a live human arm sticking up from it, and she realizes somebody's under that tree.
Of course, Fiona jumps in. Ridley Pearson also took us up the chairlift to the top of Bald Mountain. Pearson showed us scars where avalanches roll down the mountain in winter, often catching deer and elk. Their carcasses show up in the spring.
As a crime writer, I couldn't help but see a human body taking that same fall. And in Harm's Way, I actually have a body being discovered on the side of the road in that slash pile of debris that precedes an avalanche. So in this case, I have a group of Boy Scouts who are keeping that area of the highway clean, and they find more than litter along the side of the road.
Pearson likes the view from the top of Bald Mountain. One reason, from 9,000 feet, Sun Valley is a tiny island of wealth, but it's surrounded by millions of acres of wild land, dark forests, faraway glaciers. All play dangerous parts in his plots. But the centerpiece is the Sun Valley Lodge, built in the 30s by the then railroad man, Averill Harriman.
This hallway is duplicated throughout the hotel, but what's just terrific about it is you can go picture by picture through the history of the Sun Valley area.
There are pictures of an impossibly handsome young Harriman skiing with Gary Cooper and other movie stars who helped to make the Sun Valley Lodge famous.
It houses all these people that do have that money. They can be good people and they can be bad people. And so it gives me a place to pull all my people together. So it's kind of a centerpiece. It's the Lazy Susan of the books. I can pick all my little dishes off of the lodge and nosh on them.
Pearson considers himself part of the Sun Valley proletariat. He says he knows very nice, wealthy people in the valley, but he doesn't write about them. It's more fun to write about the others.
There are people who want to fly their helicopter into their house. That doesn't sit real well with people who've lived here 20 years. There are people who want their Learjet to be able to land at 3 in the morning, and that doesn't sit well with people. So there are conflicts that have arisen out of this culture clash.
Lots of clashing goes on in Pearson's Sun Valley. Masters of the universe versus mountain ranges. Haves and have-nots. Old-timers and outlanders. It all works for Ridley Pearson, and he thinks it will keep working.
Fiction is, it spins around conflict, and I look for conflict here, and if I look hard, I can find it, and I like the idea of an economic divide as a constant in these novels. This is a series, and when you envision a series, you're envisioning basically a several thousand-page story, and you need themes and threads that are going to carry through, so I mean, you could push each of these off a cliff every time and start the engine all over, but I like it when the character's growing, the town is growing, the conflict is growing, and some of that is passed on book to book.
The most recent book in Ridley Pearson's Sun Valley series is just out. It's called In Harm's Way. Linda Wertheimer, NPR News.
And you can read from Ridley Pearson's newest novel on our website, npr.org.